This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Brian Lanzone. Today on the program, a preview of the Central Coast Writers Conference with a peek into the world of publishing and writing in the digital age. Also, an exploration of Santa Barbara's Funk Zone, a neighborhood that has long been a haven for artists, but is now gentrifying and transforming into a hip place to hang out, drink wine and beer, and listen to music. And a look at a special exhibit about Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary and conversations with a prisoner, a guard, and some residents of the island. But first, Karen Pelland has a report on a Santa Barbara County nonprofit that helps women escape and recover from domestic violence.
When someone in Santa Barbara County makes a 911 call reporting domestic violence, not only do the police show up, but also an advocate from the group Domestic Violence Solutions. They're there to help that victim and their kids to safety and lead them on a path to long-term health and happiness. In 2009, Santa Barbara County Police logged 1,400 such calls. That's a 20% increase from previous years.
We are talking about women who are getting beat on. We are talking about women who come to us with broken bones and need reconstructive surgery, and that they have left the home because they know if they don't, they will be murdered and their children are at risk as well.
Bonnie Campbell is Executive Director of Domestic Violence Solutions of Santa Barbara County, which is the only nonprofit in the county of its kind. Bonnie spent the last 7 years as COO of Santa Barbara Neighborhood Clinics, and before that was heard every morning on Cruise Radio, co-anchoring a show that frequently exposed her to the world of nonprofits, inspiring her to volunteer, and setting the stage for her current gig. And for Bonnie, the opportunity to lead Domestic Violence Solutions seemed like fate.
I personally was in an abusive relationship many years ago, and I remember at the time thinking, I'm an educated woman. I know my own mind. How have I found myself in a marriage in which my husband is beating on me and I've got small children? How did this happen to me? So having had that personal experience of having to flee from domestic violence and knowing the cost involved, and that, you know, you are homeless as soon as you flee and you need services, it's always been in the back of my mind as one of those essential services that should always exist in every community so women have a place to go.
And in Santa Barbara County, that place is one of three emergency shelter facilities in Santa Barbara, Lompoc, and Santa Maria. Women and their kids can stay in these safe locations for up to 45 days. But really, Bonnie says, it's just the beginning.
When women move out of the 45-day shelter and they come into transitional housing, they can stay for up to 18 months. They have their own apartment. It's completely secure. It's absolutely confidential. And then we can do the life-changing, long-term work with these women to go over to Workforce Resource Center right here in Santa Barbara, and they build their resumes and they look for jobs, and we advocate for them all along the way. We Legal Aid Foundation, they help and assist our women and clients with their legal issues. So it's truly a, what did Hillary Clinton say? It takes a village, right? It takes a village. And we have a village here. And I want to make sure that our community is better educated to how amazing it is.
I'm curious, you go to great lengths to keep these clients' identities confidential, the locations of the shelters and the transitional housing. But if they have children, do the children continue to go to school? Because then the abusive father, let's say, can find them.
That's such a great question. I am so glad you asked that because, yeah, the kids that come are usually school age, almost always. So we have wonderful relationships with all the school districts in the county. So the first thing we do is contact the school or the teacher, and we arrange for them to understand the situation going on, sign confidentiality clauses. If the children can safely continue in their school, we arrange for that, and we make sure that the school knows that the abuser has no rights or access to the child. Sometimes we have to move them to another school where they are protected.
It should be noted that a small percentage of men are victimized in this way as well. And while Domestic Violence Solutions does not operate co-ed shelters, they do provide men with hotel vouchers, a safety plan, and referrals to places that will shelter them, like the Rescue Mission and the Salvation Army. And it's just these kinds of relationships with other organizations and government programs that make domestic violence solutions work. The proof is in the numbers.
Over 90% of the women who come through our program in the transitional housing end up being independently housed, and they do not go back to their abuser. Isn't that amazing? Over 90%. That was staggering to me when I discovered the success rate, and it's because we do the advocacy piece, we have the counseling piece, we have the safe and confidential shelter piece, and then we have the network of support for all the services that these women need to get free permanently from their abuser.
Bonnie Campbell is Executive Director of Domestic Violence Solutions of Santa Barbara County. The 35-year-old organization has never turned anybody away, and the full extent of its services and those of referral partners is significant, including a 24-hour crisis hotline anyone can call for any reason, even just to talk, though someone in immediate danger should call 911. To learn more, or for anyone interested in training to become an advocate, go to dvsolutions.org. For issues and ideas on KCBX, I'm Karen Pelland at KDB Santa Barbara.
I'm Marisa.
Coming up on Issues and Ideas, a look at the Central Coast Writers Conference. But first, let's explore a quickly changing neighborhood in Santa Barbara called the Funk Zone. Leslie Westbrook has the story.
Zone is a neighborhood undergoing revitalization in downtown Santa Barbara, California. The 10-block area is bordered by Cabrillo Boulevard and the Pacific Ocean, Lower State Street, Garden, Yaninali, and Mason Streets. In the past, the area was mainly mixed use, marine, industrial, and manufacturing, as well as popular with surfboard shapers, artists, and residents. There was also one winery, a couple of coffee houses, and a bar, making it not especially appealing to tourists. That's all changed. Over the past few years, the area has undergone and continues to undergo huge changes. The Funk Zone is now comprised of more than half a dozen wine tasting rooms, a brewery pub, a distillery with a sliver of a tasting room, new restaurants, a wine merchant run by a pair of young master sommeliers, condominium projects, along with a smattering of artist studios, art galleries, and a nonprofit art space and organization. Turning upscale, the neighborhood has lots of fans as well as some detractors. Tourists and locals alike are flocking to the Funk Zone for art openings, to sip Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays, have a brewski, listen to music, and dine on some fantastic cuisine in the zone that's especially buzzing on the weekends. Located just steps from Santa Barbara's downtown Amtrak station, visitors can jump off the train, walk less than a block, and be in the heart of the district. I'm Leslie Westbrook. Come take a stroll and meet some of the folks who make up the neighborhood as we explore the art, drink, and gentrification of the Funk Zone. Arts advocate Nathan Bonk, gallery owner Krista Dix, along with artist and art curator Brad Knack, have coordinated to keep art alive in the zone, which includes monthly art openings. Nathan offered to tour us around the neighborhood from the arts point of view.
Imagine this. So this is one of the few little residential spots in the whole Funk Zone. Everything else on this block, everything but these two houses, and it's a huge lot, is for sale as one lot.
Wow.
And whatever happens to that will dictate whether or not the Funk Zone sort of is able to stay a sort of arts district or not, I think. If we can find somebody to that sort of gets it, to take care of that lot and do something that's not just wine and alcohol or whatever.
The price for the approximately 75,000 square foot entire city block in the Funk Zone? A cool $8,750,000. Krista Dix spoke to us from her contemporary photography gallery, Wall Space Gallery.
The Funk Zone is moving very quickly. In the year that I've been down here, there have been 6 new spaces opening, all food-oriented, not a lot of arts-oriented. And I was looking for other opportunities to expand the idea of the gallery. So, Karen Sinsheimer, the curator of photography here at Santa Barbara Museum of Art, is a friend and a peer, and she and I started talking about the fact that there was no photo gallery here in Santa Barbara and that it might be a good fit. So I started traveling down and meeting people and finding out that that I was, I think, a pretty good fit. And it gave me the opportunity to really expand my program and to play with different artists and different ideas. And I could challenge myself in a way that I wouldn't be able to have that opportunity in Los Angeles or in San Francisco and any other major market where I'd have to compete, be a small fish in a very big pond. I get to be the only fish in the big pond here.
Catherine G is executive director of the Arts Fund, a nonprofit arts organization which supports Santa Barbara County artists as well as teen art mentorship programs in the schools. In the past year, over 203 local artists have been shown in the 1,000-square-foot gallery. During the past 2.5 years, Catherine has seen tremendous changes in the neighborhood.
I can remember seeing these new developments that are popping up, such as the Anacapa development with, say, 6 wineries and a brewery. These kind of new-looking high-rises where 2 of the wineries are in wall space, actually. I would say that from an artistic point of view, from the artist's perspective, gentrification has already begun. It's very prevalent, and it's sweeping through the area. I watched, in the fall of 2012, 4 artists be kicked out of their workspace who had been there for, some of them had been there for over 20 years.
Artist Zareen Zandivar was displaced from her studio earlier this year.
We tried to negotiate staying, renewing a lease, but they were increasing our rent. It's been sitting empty since then, our creative space, our livelihood, basically. It's the funk zone because it had funky people, transients, homeless drug addicts. It was not a great neighborhood. And then, of course, that's where artists get attracted to, is those neighborhoods. We don't really care. It's affordable and there's great space. So, yeah, we're the funk zone. We're the funk in the funk zone, and then they kick us out. An article came out, I think, yesterday or today about just the developers bragging about revitalizing the neighborhood with these new elements, and, you know, it really made me angry because they're not the ones who revitalized the neighborhood. We revitalized the neighborhood, the artists, we did. They just take this little area, concentrate everything there, and homogenize it. And the character that was there is gone.
We went inside a small shared studio space inhabited by artists Philip Copland and Dan Levin. Their studio is housed within a former industrial refrigerator that literally hums with activity. Assemblage artist Dan Levin.
I make objects of curiosity, and all the ingredients you see are basically a way for me to have a larger pool to pull from with these ingredients. I waited a while to get this space, and the community down here is great. People are always stopping by. Sometimes it's hard to get work done.
The funk zone has evolved into a neighborhood of contrasts. Studios like Dan Levin's juxtaposed against sleek and trendy tasting rooms and other commercial venues. We popped into River Bench, one of the newer wine tasting rooms. Bill poured me a taste in the sleek setting where visitors can do a tasting, have a glass, or even sink into comfortable couches and share a bottle of the Santa Maria-based winery's Fruit of the Vine.
A lot of rosés are kind of a really deep magenta color. This one, as you see, is like very pale, but it's just packed with flavor. And it's not sweet. It's got a little teeny tiny bit of residual sugar in there, about 0.06% residual sugar. But for all practical purposes, it's a dry wine, and it looks like it would be like drinking liquid air.
Do you mind if I have a little taste?
No, that's what I, so I pour it for you.
Okay. That's really nice. Thank you.
Over at Figueroa Mountain Brewery, affectionately referred to as the Fig, the line outside is long and there's a bouncer. This is where the over 21 and under 40 crowd meets in an indoor-outdoor space that resembles an old-timey saloon. Weathered barnwood, wooden tables and chairs inside, a patio and beer garden outside, and live music adds to the cacophony of sounds.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Skiles. I'm a professional artist and painting contractor. And this is my friend Todd Cummings.
So what do you think of this scene down here these days?
Oh, it's great. I think it's something for like the over 30s crowd, you know. The 21-year-olds can have downtown State Street, and we can have this area, and I think it's great.
This is some of the most prime real estate in all of Santa Barbara. It's just been, well, it's been utilized to a point, but it needs something like this for this age group. And
there are new places to soak up all the wine and beer, including The Lark, a fantastic new farm-to-table dining experience with an open-view kitchen and great service. Wood-fired pizzas are ordered from the Lucky Penny, a new go-to spot in the same complex that serves up thin-crust pizzas from a Sicilian wood-burning pizza oven from a small building covered in thousands of shiny pennies. At Seven Bar and Restaurant, housed in a former gay dance club called The Pub, Michael Gomez and his partners are serving up artisan cocktails along with comfort food. The interior is dark and sultry, there's a back patio, and even a co-ed bathroom with a piano.
We're looking for a place where you can go to have interesting conversations and meet people from all over, you know, and tired of all the wine, and they finally can get a cocktail and a bite to eat down here.
And tell me what's on the menu, what you're serving.
What is on the menu? So the name of the bar, Seven Bar and Kitchen, we named seven sandwiches after the seven sins.
Can art and wine coexist side by side? And is this a new kind of mixed use? Catherine G. of the Arts Fund.
You know, we're sort of poised in the epicenter of the funk zone. There's this very interesting dichotomy of activity. The Urban Wine Trail, which is an association of 17 different tasting rooms in Santa Barbara, over half of the tasting rooms are actually situated in the funk zone. So we've actually collaborated with the Urban Wine Trail Association on many different events, and the marriage of art and wine, it's just a great, great outcome. So it's really great what's happening in the funk zone.
We caught up with artist and curator Brad Knack at a bustling opening at Michael Cate. As Brad agrees, wine and art do go together.
Sometimes when in the winter when it's dark in the evening when we have the shows, the areas turn into little like lounges because people can sit anywhere and there's wine and drinks. And so there's been times when we've had really big shows with a lot of people. And I had this misconception, I think some people still have, of, oh my God, this is so great. It's all these cool buildings, and this is, my friends can open a record store, my other friend could open an alternative barber shop, and somebody can open like lawn bowling with alcohol, and I just had all these amazing concepts. And then this one guy named Nils, who's an architect, about 2 years ago said to me, you know, this is like the most expensive undeveloped real estate, you know, in Southern California. And there's no way any art community is going to happen unless somebody with a lot of money comes in and supports it. So there's a few things already, which is great. But it's going to be a really, I think, an amazing challenge to develop more of an art community here. I think it'll be a wine and beer. And I think somebody's wanting to put a hotel.
Although Nat curates shows in the funk zone, he no longer makes his art here.
I used to have a studio down here a long time ago in the little junkyard around that where they have those containers. It was like 5 years ago. It was great. I just roll up the container, pull out the art. It was $100 a month for art studio.
So where's the next funk zone? I mean, this isn't going to be funk forever.
I don't think it is at all right now. Not here anyway.
Can wine speak and art speak merge? And maybe gentrification can mean cooperation. Krista Dix.
I want more galleries down here. I want more art down here. I think that this neighborhood deserves to have a really vibrant arts community that's something a little different than State Street.
We don't know what the future holds for artists in the funk zone, or if many of them will be able to continue to afford the rising rents. Hopefully, the art of food, wine, and fine art will be able to coexist in this exciting new addition to Santa Barbara's ever-changing landscape. Special thanks to audio engineer and editor Jeremy Gaylor. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Leslie Westbrook.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Support for KCBX comes from the San Luis Podiatry Group and Stephen Burke, podorthist, providing comprehensive shoe evaluation, orthotic, and brace fabrication. Support also comes from CASA, host of Rendezvous at the San Luis Obispo Country Club. It's an evening of casual elegance, gourmet dining, fine wines, and auctions celebrating CASA's 20th anniversary on Saturday, September 7th. Tickets and information are available at slocasa.org. Coming up at 2 o'clock on KCBX, it's On Being. This week features philosopher Anthony Appiah, whose parents' marriage helped to inspire the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Stories of his multiracial, multinational family help to infuse his thinking on subjects like human identity, ethics in a world of strangers, and the catalyst for moral revolutions. That's coming up at 2 o'clock on Being here on KCBX. Still to come on Issues and Ideas, a virtual trip to Alcatraz and conversation with a former prisoner, guard, and residents of the island. But first, a look at literature in the digital age and a preview of the Central Coast Writers Conference.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. I have two guests today from the literary world. I'm talking with them in anticipation of the Central Coast Writers Conference coming up September 20th and 21st at Cuesta College. Judy Salamaca is here in the studio. She's an author, and she's also director of the Writers Conference. And on the phone, it's Gordon Warnock, who is a literary agent and editorial director of the digital publishing program at Forward Literary, where he's a founding partner. Welcome, Judy and Gordon.
Thanks, Marisa, for inviting us.
Yes, thank you.
We're going to talk about what publishing looks like in a digital world, among other things. But first, Judy, would you please give us a brief description of the Central Coast Writers Conference and tell us what its main purpose is?
This is the 29th edition of the Central Coast Writers Conference at Cuesta College.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. We celebrate our 30th next year. This is my fourth year as director, and for me, it is the most diverse program that I've put together of workshops by professional agents, authors, publishers in all genres, and it is for the writer that is just starting out or the professional writer that's already published that wants to hone their skills. And it is also for people that just want to hang out with some cool authors.
So it's kind of an all-purpose conference, something for everybody, it sounds like.
It is, but it is intended to be interactive. It is individual workshops in developing skills, no matter where you are in the spectrum.
Is there something different about this conference than other writers' conferences that you've been to?
I think the difference is the intense time with one-on-one with the presenters. The classes are small and the workshops are individual with one or maybe two at the most presenters that are working directly in a particular discipline.
So Gordon is one of your presenters, and can you just briefly tell us why you picked Gordon and what you expect him to do at the conference?
I had the honor of volunteering for the San Francisco Writers Conference, and my duty was to usher people in at the agent's pitch session, which had a room full of agents and twice as many attendees that wanted to talk for 5 minutes with the agents and pitch their project. And Gordon was right sitting next to me, and I just heard the approach that he had, the gentleness, but the emphaticness that he had with the authors that were pitching. And I liked his style and wanted him to come and present at our conference.
Okay. And Gordon, can you just give us a little sneak preview? What are you going to be talking about with the writers and potential writers that are coming to you?
Oh, we'll be doing a lot of one-on-one meetings with the writers and trying to figure out not only if they have a project that we are wanting to work with in particular, but also if there's a way that we can sort of guide them to realize where they're best fit. As you may be aware, there are a lot of different areas of publishing these days, and digital and traditional, agented and not agented, trade, university, and so forth. And a lot of the time, the writers simply don't know what they are, where they're best fit. And so we're trying to guide them and see what we can do to help them out on their own specific career path, whether or not it has anything to do with us in the end.
I have a young friend who recently wrote her first novel for young adults. She couldn't get a publisher, so she is now self-published, and she's off to a good start. Mm-hmm. Is that common these days?
Oh, yeah. Self-publishing is something that I am completely behind. It has several purposes. It can be used as both a primary means of publication for projects and authors that are best fit for it, but also as a tool to be used in conjunction with traditional publishing. And it can also help you move from one area to the other and so forth. And we're seeing a lot more of that in what they're calling hybrid authors, which is one of the things that we specialize in at Forward, working across several different methods and outlets of publication.
Can you give us a description of what a hybrid author is?
Hybrid author is one who basically utilizes different formats for getting their material out there, whether it's someone who is writing a novel who also can branch out into areas like graphic novels or video games or apps or something like that. But it's also someone who utilizes both the traditional and a self-publishing toolbox.
Mm-hmm. With the digital world, it's a lot easier for anybody to get their words out in front of eyeballs. And what I'd like to know is, what is the advantage to coming to somebody like you, a literary agent?
Well, I'd first like to point out that not everyone is writing something that is fit for a literary agent and a Big Five publisher. I'm the first to say you do not always need an agent, depending upon what you're writing. For example, if you're writing something that is very literary, like a collection of short stories or something like that, most of the time you would pitch that yourself to an independent press or a university press or someone who is more hungry for that type of work. But if you are a writer of, we'll say you're writing young adult fantasy or something like that, something that is very mainstream and it follows the genre conventions and all the rest of it, getting an agent will not only open the doors to the certain tier of publishers that require agented submissions, but it will also ensure that, first of all, you're taken care of with things like contracts and so forth. You're not being taken advantage of, but also all of the sub-rights and additional avenues for your work. If you think your novel might make a good film or it might make a good audiobook or something like that, an agent will work with you to take advantage of those rights and make sure that your work is out there and not only published, but published well. And that's really important with just the volume of books that are out there these days.
What does it mean to be published well?
Just being in a place that is going to help you out, not only a publisher that will do well by you, but will also be conducive to your career. I deal a lot with nonfiction, and with nonfiction, we're very concerned with things like branding and platform and so forth. Those principles are also utilized in fiction as well, but it's showcasing yourself as an author, as a certain type of author, so people know to come to you for a certain type of work, and they know that you do that well, and you're well-distributed, and you're well-edited, and so forth. There are quite a few startup publishers these days, just because it's so easy to start up a publisher. I mean, the tools are there, and that's both a good and a bad thing. Sometimes you have people who really know what they're doing, and sometimes you have people who don't. And a big part of the agent's job is to find a good publisher for you rather than just a publisher.
Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about the opportunities in the digital world, there's been an area that is overlooked, and that is the editing process. And many authors have self-published too soon. And that's where an editor and an agent can really help hone your manuscript and make sure that when you do publish it, it's not out there just floundering because it is not ready for publication.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there's a term that some of my partners and I have been kicking around. We call it premature e-publication. And it's pretty much what it sounds like. It's not how it should be. It's something that the author just jumps on right away. They say that, you know, well, I have something. I can have an ebook tomorrow if I want to. And they can, but they don't bother to take the steps to, you know, design a good cover or to do a good layout or editorial or any of the other things that a traditional publisher would do for you. Yes, you can do that well by yourself, by hiring professionals and making sure that everything is taken care of. But a lot of people don't. And so you need to realize that if you're going to self-publish something, you need to realize what your own strengths are, what you are good at, and what you need help on, and really be honest with yourself.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guests today are Judy Salamaca, who is the director of the Central Coast Writers Conference that's coming up on September 20th and 21st at Cuesta College, and also Gordon Warnock, who is a literary agent and founding partner at Forward Literary, and he'll be presenting at the conference. Judy, you have a book, and I'd like to hear about the process of getting that book in front of readers. Do you have an agent and a publisher?
We have a publisher, small press publisher. It is a niche biography in that it is the only biography that has been written about Colonel Thomas Baker, and he is the namesake of Bakersfield, California, which is where I came from. The book actually started by me attending this writer's conference. And then through the years, the 4 years, I'm co-authored with Sandra Mittelstadt. And Sandra and I would pitch it to take it to the editors that were at the conferences. And it has morphed 3 times into 3 different evolutions until what we have now is a biography, yes, but it's fictionalized and told through dialogue. And we were able to work with the great-great-grandson in order to have the facts checked and the era checked for validity. But we tried to make it a fun read, particularly for school children, although it's an adult book. I wanted a children's book to begin with, but it turned out to be an adult book the way it ultimately came out.
Is it available in digital form?
Not as yet. I was one of those premature ebook people that did. Somebody said we should test it out by going digital, and that was not a great idea. And luckily, only the people involved in the book were the ones that bought it. But so we did go through print with Bear State Books, which is as I said, it's a small press of California history books. And we're very slowly right now and focusing right now in Bakersfield, and it's doing quite well. The point I wanted to make about the conference, though, is that we did workshop it through the editors, the agents, the publishers, not necessarily to get a publisher or an agent, but more to do what Gordon said, is to find out what our niche was and how we should write it and what voice to develop it in. And got incredible feedback from Jordan Rosenfeld, who had written a book called Make a Scene. And we actually followed her template into make 29 scenes in the book about the life and times of Colonel Thomas Baker.
Gordon, you, as the director, or the editorial director of digital publishing at Forward Literary, are in charge of kind of a new frontier here. How are today's agencies adapting to the digital publishing world?
That varies quite a bit. We're trying a lot of new things that aren't typical of agents right now. We're trying to reach across boundaries and see what we can do to bolster the author's career in multiple ways. E-publishing, as far as across agencies is concerned, it's fairly common at some level. Most agencies that I know of are using it as a tool to bring out backlist and out-of-print books that had essentially just been sitting there not doing anything, and now they're once again available to the public and to get new sales. And that's a wonderful tool. We're dealing with a lot of original pieces, interstitials in between major releases, and things that can help to create an author's career rather than just maintain it. We're trying to use it in ways that will find a new audience and expand the reach into different areas, and also help bridge gaps in between books that they're writing that might be a bit of a stretch, but still have some common ground. And so I've been doing that with a few of my clients, and we've seen some good success there.
Your focus is nonfiction. You represent both fiction and nonfiction, but it looks like the majority of what you work on at Forward Literary is nonfiction. I was impressed with the very specific directions that you give on your page about what you're accepting and what you're not accepting, how you want queries submitted to you. How do you know what is hot and what is not? Does an agency like yours do research among readers to know what people want?
Well, we pay attention to a lot of the online discussion that's happening. Several of our agents are top book bloggers in their genres, and so they know what that discussion is all about. And we also pay attention to the book deals as they happen and see where things are moving, and we can anticipate which markets become saturated and then which ones become logical next steps and which ones open up completely. So it's all kind of a calculation that we work on. And then, of course, there are always passion projects that we take on from time to time where we know it's going to be a bit of a difficult sell just due to timing or what have you, but just the book is so good that we have to try and make a go of it. It's great when you see something like that really take off. Like I had you may have heard of new adult as being a hot new genre, and it's something that I had been into as a reader and as a young agent since my first days of agenting. And back then, new adult was not a thing. It was, you know, just kind of an overlooked age group. And I got this one new adult memoir, and it took me 3 years to finally get a book deal with that one. But it's out now in hardcover. It's doing very well. And now new adult is this hot new thing. And so it's just wonderful to see things like that happen.
And what is new adult?
It's essentially the next logical step after young adult, averaging age 18 to 25, dealing with issues of being out on your own for the first time. It's a lot less of the new experiences that you'd find in high school, which is what young adult is, and it's not quite the existence of having a family and having a steady job and all the rest of that that adult books would tend to approach. It's a lot of the in-between stages. It really makes for some interesting stories, I think, and I'm glad that it's finally getting recognition.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on your webpage that you said you don't want anything about werewolves or vampires or science fiction. Now, is that because it's just not your personal taste as an agent or because there's not a market for that?
Well, yes. it's more of just not being my taste. It's a lot of that stuff is very saturated right now. And we are seeing a few pieces like Benjamin Percy's new book, Red Moon, is brilliant. It deals with werewolves, and it's an adult book. And so you see occasionally something like that happening. But as far as it being a boom or a trend or what have you, it's largely passed. And it also just doesn't interest me. I mean, there are plenty of other agents who love that kind of stuff, and I'm just not one of them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Gordon is talking about the new adult because he is joining Katya Singel in the workshops for the teens this year. We've had a teen program for several years, particularly for 4 years, and specifically Katya and Gordon are designing something that only they'll be talking to the teens, and many of those, Gordon, are students that have come for 4 years, and they're ready to be the new adult. That's a marvelous program that we've had, and we have scholarships available for middle to high school students from PG&E to participate in that program. And we also have the teacher program, which is brand new, modeled after the student program. It was so popular with our teens that we have developed a credit or non-credit program for teachers to come and learn what the teens are learning so they can take it back to the classrooms and develop the writing skills of the English and history students in the schools locally.
We're talking about the Central Coast Writers Conference, which is coming up September 20th through 21st at Cuesta College. That was Judy Salamaca that you just heard, and also Gordon Warnock. Judy's the director of the conference, and Gordon is a literary agent who will be presenting at the conference. How many teens do you get at your conference each year?
Traditionally, we've gotten 25 to 30. And they're all on full scholarships by PG&E. Our goal this year for teachers is to have at least that many teachers, and we have stipends available for the teachers. And if we can get 25 teachers to come and start spreading the word of great writing that our presenters present, that will just be such a boon to the classroom.
Tell us about some of the other highlights at the conference, Judy, that you're particularly looking forward to.
I heard Constance Hale up at San Francisco, and she's a grammarian. She's written a couple books on grammar that are absolutely so much fun. I remember in school having to diagram sentences. Well, she makes diagramming fun, and it's the both of her books take words and take writing and make the words more active. She just does marvelous workshops. Katya Singal writes in nonfiction, and not only has she written a book about minor league baseball in the South, in Kentucky, I think it is, but she also has written magazine articles all over the world and has a real pulse for the type of articles that are needed and looked for out there.
So the conference is not just about writing books, it's about writing for magazines and
yes,
other publications as well.
And memoirs, always, life story is always a big opportunity at our conference. And we have Stephen Blake Mattee, who is going to be talking about the hero's journey applied to somebody's life story and memoir. We talked about the teen writing. Shannon Messenger is a fantasy fiction writer that the teen, she's hot right now with many of our teens and is finding great success in her fantasy writing. And so she is with us. So just all over the board. And screenwriter Dave Congleton, who came to California in order to be a screenwriter, did the Hollywood scene, wasn't finding great success, came to San Luis Obispo and found great success in being on the radio as a talk show host, got back into doing his writing again. Charlotte Alexander, his wife, encouraging him, and he has his first movie coming out this fall and an option on his second movie. So he's going to be teaching screenwriting. So variety of between short story to all kinds of fiction and nonfiction will be available for writers.
And if someone wants to learn more about the conference, register, contact you, how does one do that?
www.communityprograms.net is the actual site at Cuesta College Community Programs in order to register. We also are on Facebook, Central Coast Writers Conference, or you can always Google Central Coast Writers Conference and it'll get you right into the Community Programs Network.
Okay, great. And Gordon, if someone wants to know more about you or your company, Forward Literary, how does one do that?
We're online as well, every social media known to man, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Pinterest, all the rest of them. We also can be found at forwardliterary.com. That's forward like a book, F-O-R-E-W-O-R-D, literary.com.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Gordon Warnock and Judy Salamaca. I'm Marisa Waddell with you for Issues and Ideas.
San Francisco.
You're listening to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. On Being with Krista Tippett is coming up at 2 o'clock. But first, the final story on Issues and Ideas takes us to San Francisco with travel writer Molly Blaisdell.
Alcatraz, the notorious prison, is now on display at the Hyatt Regency San Francisco. Please join me, Molly Blaisdell, your guide to life on the Rock. If you can't make it out to the prison while visiting San Francisco, Alcatraz is on display at this iconic Guinness Book of World Records hotel in the atrium lobby of the Hyatt Regency San Francisco. Come along as we see the sights of 3,000 square feet of a prison recreated in this amazing lobby, and we revisit some of those memories of prison life with a former guard, a prisoner, and resident family. We're here with a very notorious man who is affiliated with Alcatraz Island and the prison. I'm going to let him introduce himself and tell us what his affiliation with Alcatraz really was.
My name is Robert Luke, and my Alcatraz prison number was 1118, and I was out there from 1954 to 1959, and I was released from Alcatraz.
What were you in prison for?
I was a bank robber.
So, Bob, you were a prisoner on Alcatraz.
If you could take us back to that day when you first stepped off the boat and onto the rock, if you can kind of give us some reminiscence.
Okay, first I was in Leavenworth Federal Prison in Kansas, and me and another con tried to escape, and that's why we were sent to Alcatraz, because everyone was sent there for doing something wrong in another prison. So I got there early in the morning, and there was eight of us, and I was shackled my left ankle to the right ankle of another prisoner. So we got off the boat, got onto a little blue bus, and rode up the hill and went in through what I learned later was the basement, which is where all the tourists go in now. So my first glimpse of the prison was later, after we showered and got our clothes and got a speech by the warden, a new mugshot. And then we went up to the cell house, and my first impression of that cell house is how small it was.
Did you share that prison cell with somebody?
No, we had our own cells. So there's really nothing to be afraid of in Alcatraz. We all knew about it before we ever got there. And we knew the food was good. You had your own cell, recreation, and work, and books to read. So what else do you want if you have due time?
How many years were you on Alcatraz?
I was there 5 years and 12 days. I was in prison altogether about 11 years.
So you tried to escape from Leavenworth. Obviously, that wasn't successful. Did you ever try to escape from Alcatraz?
No, I never had any inkling of trying to escape from there.
Why not? Were the rumors true? It was impossible to get out?
Well, I only had about 5 years left in my sentence, so there was no reason to try to escape.
You got off the island, off the rock. Tell me the first thing you did when you hit San Francisco.
Well, San Francisco was just a go through San Francisco. Had a guard with me, and we were in a government car and drove me out there. First impression I got was all the color and all the movement from people and the distance you could see. And see women for the first time in 6, 7 years, and kids, all the cars and noise. It was really confusing. And it was tough the first couple of years because it had been so easy to get a gun and, you know, start up again. But I fought it off, and it's been 53 years since I've been out.
Tell us the real nitty-gritty. What really goes on in a prison?
Well, it's very boring. If they made a movie, the real story of a prison, you'd just fall asleep. Nobody go see it. Just day after day, and in Alcatraz is very regimented, more so than any other prison. You did everything the same time every day, all year, year after year after year. I was never afraid of anybody in prison. I was very violent, didn't take much to set me off, so I was never really afraid.
Well, you seem so kind and gentle right now, sitting next to you here in this grand lobby of the Hyatt Regency. I can't see the violent bone.
On the back cover of my book, I wrote a poem. It explains about the dark man that's still inside me. So he's always there, right near the surface.
Thank you, Bob Luke. I'm sure most of us would like to know more about Robert Luke. So he's got a book out called Rock Secret, Surviving Alcatraz. Now, we've got the next guest coming up, joining us here at our virtual tour of Alcatraz here at the Hyatt Regency San Francisco. Jim Albright is a former prison guard and the last one off Alcatraz when the prison closed 50 years ago. So Jim Albright is here to talk to us about what it's like to be a guard on one of the most notorious prisons in the world.
I worked at Alcatraz from 1959 till 1963, and I started there when I was 24 years old with no previous law enforcement experience whatsoever. I had never been in a prison before, let alone work one. It kind of takes a special person to work in a prison, and I always told my wife it took a certain kind of a nut, and I was that kind of a nut.
Well, at 24 years old, your first job, and it's Alcatraz. Wasn't that a little scary?
Yes, it was. Yeah. We was living in the Denver area, Aurora, Colorado at the time. I come home from work one night, and Kathy says, "You have a letter from the warden at Alcatraz," and he sent me a letter asking if I would accept appointment at Alcatraz. We talked it over, and we decided to go try it and put our year's probation in out there and then transfer back to Englewood, Colorado.
Imagine you lived on the island, correct?
We lived in town for about 6 weeks, and then we got housing on the island.
So what was it like to raise an infant and a small toddler on a prison island?
It was just like a little town. We had our own store, our own post office with our own postmark. We had a little church.
We had a social hall where we could have dinners and dances and stage plays. We had a bowling alley.
It sounds like a resort environment when out of prison.
It was just like a little town, even with the gossip.
So you were the guard, and this is your first gig, and you're a new husband, a new dad. What was it like when you came up against these criminals day in and day out?
I did my time with humor. I would joke with them and things like that, and I was firm but fair.
When you spend so much time in an environment like that, do you get to know their personalities?
Some were very, very intelligent, but they had that little quirk where they thought they were much smarter than they were and that they could beat everybody and beat the system. I remember one time, to give you a little example, I was waiting to open for chow. There was an inmate laying in the cell waiting to go to chow. And like I said, I did it with humor, and I looked out at him, and I says, Larry, I think I'll rehabilitate you. And he just started laughing. And he says, like hell you will. He says, your hobby might be building model airplanes. He says, mine's robbing banks. And when I get this 30 years done, I'm going to rob another one.
So, Jim, tell me about a couple of the prisoners that really stood out for you.
And, of course, Alvin Karpis was one. And like they say, he was kind of an odd person. He was quiet and stayed to himself, but he walked on his toes. You know, this is an odd thing. And then another one that comes to mind was Mickey Cohen, who was a Los Angeles mobster. And he was the same as Al Capone. He had a lot of murder raps, but they couldn't get him on it, so they got him on income tax evasion. And Mickey worked for me in the clothing room, and he was a cleanliness nut. I mean, a real nut about it. And he asked for a job working for me in the clothing room. And the reason he wanted to come down there is because my crew got to shower every day because they was handling the dirty clothes, and he wanted to do that.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for talking with us. It's a very thrilling story, and I understand that we can see some of your personal artifacts and collection here at the Hyatt Regency exhibit.
That's true, yeah. And I even have my original 1959 ID card that was issued to me the first day I started there. And this that I have on is my original 1959 issue uniform.
And Jim is in full uniform, and there will be photos that accompany this broadcast. So you'll be able to go to my website, herjourneyto50.com, and you'll be able to meet Jim in person. At least you'll be able to see his photos anyway. Thank you so much, Jim.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If you'd like to read up more about being a resident and one of the guards on Alcatraz, Jim Albright has his book out, and it's called Last Guard Out. Now, let's hear from another resident. Let's meet Jim Albright's better half.
I'm Catherine Irene Albright. I'm Jim Albright's wife of 58 years. I lived on Alcatraz for the last 4 years it was in operation.
And I understand you had quite an outing coming from Colorado to the San Francisco Bay Area. He told us a little bit earlier about that first journey over the Bay Bridge. What are your memories of that?
Well, I was scared to death, wondering what we were doing. I mean, it was a big move since we'd sold everything we owned and had a 19-month-old boy with us and no place to live. And so it was an experience, but it turned out great, and I would do it again if I had to.
That 19-month-old baby boy that you brought across the Bay Bridge into this terrifying new world is sitting right next to you here at the Hyatt Regency San Francisco. Maybe you can introduce yourself. You've grown up a little bit since the move to San Francisco.
Yes, just a little bit. I'm Ken Albright, and I'm 55 now, so I've grown up just a little bit.
What can you tell us from the memory of those stories that your mom and dad have shared with you?
Well, I remember snippets of being young there, and I remember painting the back of the lieutenant's house. I was kind of an ornery kid. The maintenance workers had left some paint out and some paint brushes, and a buddy of mine and I decided to help out. Unfortunately, they were painting the fence and with silver, and we were painting the back of the house, which was white with silver.
Do you have any memories at all being a young child besides the painting of the back of the house?
I remember riding my bicycle inside the apartment, you know, due to the parade grounds being closed a few times, and they would let me ride it inside the apartment, which was pretty large. And I remember walking on the seawall and then getting the rear posterior warmed up for doing so. other than that, I don't remember a whole lot.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
I'm Jolene Babiak, and I was a child on Alcatraz. I was there when I was 7 to 9 and also when I was 15.
Oh, you didn't do it right the first time, huh, Jolene?
Two-time loser.
Oh, no. So how is it that somebody, you're obviously a resident at Alcatraz, you're not a prisoner, and you were very young at the time. So how is it that you returned to Alcatraz?
Well, my father worked there for 9 years. He was assigned to Alcatraz in 1954. And we lived on the island for about 2 years and then moved to the city, and he commuted. And then in 1961, his job, he took a promotion, and that required that we move back to the island. So I was about 15. We moved back to Alcatraz in 1962.
Oh, my gosh. What a culture shock. But then you were only there for a year, year and a half, right?
Well, yeah, it wasn't really. I mean, you know, we all went to school in the city, so there was no culture shock. We were just living in a different neighborhood. Alcatraz were the ultimate in gated communities, you know, so we were quite privileged.
Right, and you had guards of your own, right, all over the place.
In towers.
Tell me what it was like, Jolene, what your experience maybe the first time around before you were commuting back and forth to school.
We moved on to the island in April of 1954, and I was 7, you know, and so my mother kept pretty good watch over me, but there were about 60 or 70 or 80 kids on the island.
Any other memories?
I was there on the 1962 escape from Alcatraz, you know, the Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
Of course, I slept through it. And the siren woke me up, and I was 15 years old, ready to go to school. It was like my next to the last day of school.
Wow.
And my mother came and met me on the stairs and said, "Get dressed. There's been an escape. We're going to have to search the house." And that was pretty cool. And, you know, we until the moment when we had to go down into the basement, which I didn't really care for that too much. But we did it. We went down there and noodled around to see if there was any escaping convict. And there wasn't.
Do you have any special favorites of the exhibit pieces here?
Oh, I like all the people that it attracts, all my friends from back in the day, and yeah, it's really fun.
Great. Well, thank you for being here with us, Jolene.
Thanks for joining me and the Alcatraz alumni, including prisoners, guards, and former residents. I'm Molly Blaisdell, reporting from Hyatt Regency San Francisco and Embarcadero Center.
San Francisco, your golden sun will shine for me.
And that's Issues and Ideas for today. I'm Brian Lanzone. Up next, it's On Being with Krista Tippett. Support for KCBX is provided by Cal Poly Arts, with single tickets and subscriptions available for more than 40 events at the Performing Arts Center this coming season. Tickets and information are available at 756-4849 or at calpolyarts.org. In the new effects series, The Bridge, Demian Bachir plays a Mexican detective working a homicide case with El Paso cops at the Texas-Mexican border. On the next Fresh Air, he'll talk about that role as well as playing a drug lord on the Showtime series Weeds and Fidel Castro in the film Che. Join us at 3 o'clock for Fresh Air here on Public Radio KCBX. This is KCBX, HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. We're streaming live on the web at kcbx.org.